For those of you new to the Independent Institute, hopefully you picked up a packet when you registered. The Independent Institute is a nonprofit public policy research institute. We are an academic research institute and produce many books. We have a quarterly journal called The Independent Review. Steve Schmansky, who's here, has been a contributor to it. And we organize many conference and media programs based on that work. Our interest is not to play politics or to get involved in battles of different types, but more to hopefully illuminate different ideas and get to the heart of issues that are affecting people. Also in your packet, you'll find a sheet on future, actually on today's program, but also it lists two upcoming events. The next policy forum that we'll be holding will be on April 25th. It's going to be a debate on the issue of affirmative action. It'll be a debate between two regents at the University of California, Ward Connerly and Bill Bagley. And Ward Connerly has a new book that's just come out, so we expect that one to be a ferociously interesting one. The second program is on May 4th. That topic is going to be on the issue of war and government propaganda and the state itself. The two speakers for that will be Robert Stinnett, who many of you may know used to be a reporter here at the Oakland Tribune. He's the author of a number of books, the most recent of which from the Free Press is a book called Day of Deceit, and it's based on the new releases of information about the archives regarding Pearl Harbor. The second speaker is Bruce Porter, who's a professor of political science at Brigham Young University, who's also of another book from the Free Press called War and the Rise of the State, The Military Foundations of Modern Politics. Tonight's program is, I think, a fascinating one on many levels. Our two speakers are renowned sports economists and economists in other fields. Roger Noel and Rodney Fort will be examining issues pertaining to professional sports teams, stadiums, and many other issues. Roger is co-author with Andrew Zimbalist of a book from Brookings that some of you have picked up called Sports Jobs and the State, Sports Jobs and Taxes, which has just come out in paperback. And Rodney is co-author of a new book called Hard Green with James Quirk. Over a couple hundred years ago, as many of you know, Adam Smith wrote a book called The Wealth of Nations, at least that's a shortened title. And in the book, he critiqued the use of government privileges as what he considered to be the source of monopoly. The system then was known as mercantilism, and it was a system of government subsidies and tariffs and royal privileges of licensing and many other benefits that were bestowed upon certain people in society, largely business people, who were considered to be favored in some respect. And those that did not have that privilege bestowed upon them simply could not pursue either those occupations or they were at a distinct disadvantage. In so doing, Smith showed that government privileges resulted in monopoly that made it difficult for other firms to compete. It would be similar to a situation if the Independent Institute suddenly was awarded in our day hundreds of millions of dollars and we were given a coliseum to hold events like this in and many other benefits, how that would affect other sources of information in society. I can leave that to you. Anyway, Smith's proposal was to abolish such privileges, and that's what led to a lot of the Industrial Revolution, in our opinion, as far as the liberalization of economic behavior and sort of an end of autocracy. Many people have claimed that professional sports are different, and especially this is true on the municipal level. As you know, Americans love pro baseball and football and hockey and basketball and increasingly other sports like soccer and golf and so forth. The question is, has this passion blinded them to the realities of the way professional sports interfaces with government policy? In the Bay Area here, there are numerous different sports complexes. There's a new one going up in Sacramento right now. Of course, there's one about to be opened in San Francisco. These different stadiums and other complexes are involving governments in different ways, and that's part of what our discussion will be tonight. I was going to start with Roger Noll, and Roger is the Morris Doyle Centennial Professor and Director of the Public Policy Program at the Department of Economics at Stanford University. He received his BS from Caltech and his PhD in economics from Harvard. In addition to the book Sports, Jobs, and Taxes I mentioned, he's the author of the book Challenges to Research Universities and many articles in scholarly journals. His current research work focuses on studies of the legal system and judicial review, economics and politics, utility regulation, but especially this field of sports. So I'm delighted to introduce Roger Noll.
It's terrible when the person who introduces you encapsulizes your whole talk in about three sentences, because now I've got to figure out a way to keep you awake through the 45-sentence version of exactly what he said about Adam Smith. But basically, the point is right. If we think about the sports business, it's an entertainment business. It's not unlike, actually, a lot of other aspects of the entertainment business, which are recipients of public subsidies. The opera, some theaters, many communities provide public subsidies of theaters. They provide subsidies of symphony orchestras and ballet. And there's a whole bunch of other things in the entertainment business that receive some sort of public subsidization. And in that sense, one might think, well, gee, maybe this is sort of like that category. On the other hand, the vast majority of the entertainment business does not receive subsidies. In fact, the things that account for most of the money have to do with motion picture theaters and movies and television. And they, at one point a long time ago, the television industry was given the electromagnetic spectrum rather than having to buy it, as was has been the case for radio telephones. But aside from that sort of once and for all giveaway of the spectrum, it's not subsidized either. So the very first point we can ask ourselves is this really a smart thing to do? Is it smart to pick out one particular industry, namely professional team sports, which receives a lion's share of these subsidies, and provide public subsidies for that, and thereby competitively advantage it against other parts of the entertainment industry, which have to compete for your dollar, your entertainment dollar, without such subsidies? And indeed, as David said, there's been a number of arguments advanced as to why, indeed, it might be so, that it makes sense to subsidize professional sports. Now, what both Rod and I are going to tell you is that as an economic matter, the arguments put forth as to why one needs to subsidize professional sports are fatuous. This is, in fact, just a straightforward subsidy. It falls in the same category of most other subsidies we think of, such as agricultural price supports and whatever, which is that a particular interest or a particular industry finds itself in an important bargaining power position relative to elected political officials and simply extorts them. It simply demands these subsidies or else it will go away and play its game somewhere else. But let's go through what the arguments are and sort of figure out why we will tell you, we will sing this song to you about the illegitimacy of these subsidies. First of all, we can just quickly dismiss of the view that indeed a local government will generate sufficient tax revenues from the business surrounding the stadium, not only the in-stadium activities, but the gas stations and sports bars and whatever that are built in the neighborhood of the sports facility. There has yet to be a stadium built in the last 20 years for which that is true. And the reason it's true is that is this point I made before about competition, that sports facilities basically are filled with people who live in the local community the act of creating this force facility doesn't cause them to have more income to spend. It reallocates the income they spend, and it pretty much reallocates the discretionary income they spend on recreation and entertainment from other activities to attending the sporting events. So as a result, for every increase in the sales of gas stations near the sport facility, there's a decrease in sales of gas stations 3-4 miles away. For every increase in sales at sports bars and restaurants near the sports facility, there's an equivalent decrease elsewhere in places elsewhere in other neighborhoods that are not near the sports facility. All the evidence indicates that, indeed, there is no effect at all on the local economy in terms of total expenditures on recreation and entertainment. That indeed, all that it does is reallocate it from other things into the sports team. And there may be a slightly higher tax rate on tickets to sporting events. Around here, it typically is 10% instead of the sales tax of 8.5%. So there may be a little bit of incremental tax revenue, but not enough to pay for this facility. Typically, when citizens are provided with ballot initiatives in which to evaluate whether to support, where they have to vote on providing a public subsidy to a stadium, they're presented with financial analyses that say, well, we're going to collect this much money from various kinds of taxes on tickets and all the rest, and that's enough to pay for the public indebtedness arising from the sports facility. But typically the problem with that is that it measures the gross income flows in the stadium rather than the net. It doesn't take account of the reductions in tax revenues it'll accrue from other places. And moreover, those financial projections are always completely based on the presumption that the stadium will sell out throughout its entire life of the bond. That is to say, if we float a 30-year debt, literally every single seat in the stadium will be sold for literally every game for that entire 30-year period. In reality, there is an attendance effect, an important attendance effect from building a new facility, but it only lasts for about 5 or 6, 7 years. And basically what a new sports facility does is it causes people to want to go to games a little bit more when it first opens to see what the new facility is like. Typically, once they get there, since like every other thing that goes on in the American economy, there's actually been enormous technological progress in stadiums over the past 30 years. A brand new stadium is nicer. It's easier to get around in, easier to get in and out of. There's better concessions. There's better line of sight in the seats. There's more room for your feet. There's all kinds of amenities that didn't exist in previous stadiums. So by and large, it's a more interesting experience. People like it more. Hence, all else equal, such as the quality of the team they're coming to see, they'll be slightly more likely to attend. And that sort of lasts for a while, but it eventually sort of wears off. And 5 to 7 to 9 years off down the road, there varies a little bit from city to city and team to team. Attendance is back down to where it would have been had there been no new facility at all. So for that reason, these financial projections that somehow it's in the long run not going to cost taxpayers anything, it's going to be self-financing, is literally always wrong. All right? It simply isn't true, and it's based upon completely unrealistic financial projections. Well, the second reason we might imagine that people invest in this, which is also an argument put forth by proponents of subsidized stadiums, is that there will be an economic development impact. All right, that it's not just that this story I gave before about people attending and paying taxes in the stadium. This is sort of a global economic benefit argument. And here the story is this is really a public investment of the same sort as widening a freeway, or installing the sewer systems, or other kinds of public investments that would facilitate the development of other kind of businesses. And you get two versions of this. Version number one is that it will cause increased tourism in the local area. So people will come in from out of town, they'll attend games, they'll stay in hotels, they'll go to restaurants. So there'll be some sort of net increase in business in the local community through all the activities of visitors who come. That's the first part of the story. And the second part of the story is that businesses looking for places to locate facilities, particularly corporate headquarters, will be more likely to locate their corporate headquarters in your community if you have a spanking new fancy sports facility. Well, what are the facts here? Well, to begin with, this is sort of like an infant industry argument in international trade, right? That you're sort of getting something started because you think you're going to sell a lot of it to other countries. Only here it's not countries, it's regions and metropolitan areas versus hinterlands. Somehow we can imagine thinking of Oakland as in an international competition, if you will, with Sacramento. And somehow people are going to be driving down from Sacramento to attend Oakland games. There is an element of truth to this, but it again is de minimis. And indeed, the most successful stadiums are one like the Pac Bell Park will be next year, which Pac Bell Park is basically now completely sold out for next season. So the likelihood of anybody in Sacramento saying, gee, let's go down to San Francisco next week and go to a baseball game, it's impossible. Can't get a ticket. All right. In other words, the more successful the facility is, the more likely it is that everything is going to be sold out to people who live in the area, and there's going to be absolutely no tourism effect. Moreover, the argument for the tourism effect came about from some surveys of stadium football and baseball stadiums undertaken in the 1950s. Now, I'm one of the few people in this room who can remember the 1950s. I was even born then. But in the 1950s, you will recall that almost all the professional sports teams in the U.S. were all packed into the Northeast Corridor of the U.S. There were a couple of football teams on the West Coast a team here and there. But for the most part, you can draw a little box from Milwaukee to St. Louis to Washington, D.C. to Boston, and almost all the professional sports teams were located in that little box. The rest of the country had no major league professional sports. And indeed, when I was 12 years old, we once planned a summer vacation to go to Milwaukee and Chicago to see baseball games. That was a reasonable thing to do for a kid growing up on the West Coast. Their parents say, when you're 12 years old, oh boy, wouldn't you love to see a major league baseball game? This year we'll spend our vacation driving to the Midwest, seeing some baseball games, and driving home. That would be totally ludicrous in the current environment because there are so many professional sports teams. They're all over. The vast majority of the American population lives within an hour or two drive of a major league sports team. So the notion that people are going to be planning their vacations around attending professional sporting events, even if it's the case, all the seats are not sold out in advance to people who live locally, is not very plausible. All right. And now these are all the arguments why it's true. But if we look at the actual data, there's a number of interesting studies that have been done in the last 7 or 8 years comparing either the same city through time, before and after a stadium is built, before and after, not just a renovation or a replacement of an existing stadium, but even bringing a new team into an area. Through time, what is the effect on total employment, total income within the area? Is there this corporate headquarters effect? Is there this increased tourism effect? Can you pick it up in any specific industry or for employment in general? Or alternatively, if we take a sample of the many, many, many metropolitan areas in the U.S. with populations between 1 and 3 million, about half of them have Major League Football, Major League Baseball teams, and about half of them don't. So is there any trend through time between those that have Major League teams and those that don't? And the best answer, the best guess we have, all the statistical results say there that you cannot reject statistically the notion that there's simply no effect at all. But if someone pointed a gun to your head and said you have to guess what the number is, the point estimate is minus 0.3% on employment and income. That is to say, the act of constructing a professional sports team actually does more harm than good. Why does it do more harm than good? Well, the reason it does more harm than good is a lot of these facilities are not used very much. And if you stick a brand new fancy football stadium or even baseball stadium in the middle of a vibrant downtown neighborhood, you will create a depressed area because a very small fraction of the time is actually being used and generating traffic, and the rest of the time it's this great big black hole of economic activity. Nothing is happening. It's this huge, closed, monstrous facility that is plunked right in the middle of your downtown area, And so it actually detracts from the attractiveness. Indeed, the reducto ad absurdum of building facilities like this, there are actually two of them. One is the Superdome in New Orleans, which has created the highest crime neighborhood in just about the U.S. It is completely unsafe to be anywhere near that facility if there's not a sporting event going on there, because it's completely wiped out the neighborhood. Another one is Pro Player Stadium in Miami. Getting back to our story about sports bars and restaurants and gas stations, the people who built the stadium in Miami realized full well that there potentially was money to be made in sports bars, restaurants, and gas stations. So they designed the stadium such that it is only approachable by freeway and is completely encircled by a freeway. So when you enter and leave the freeway, you can't get to the surrounding community. You can't get from the stadium to the surrounding community. And then inside the stadium are all these fancy things that are all operated by the teams. All right. So the whole idea is to encapsulate all of this economic benefit in terms of localized increments to business for the benefit of the tenant, as contrasted for the benefit of the neighborhood. So all it takes, of course, to get this minus 0.3% as a statistical result is a handful of ludicrous examples, which would cause significant effects in their localities. And then for the most rest of the cities, the best hypothesis would be it really doesn't matter. And this, again, is consistent with the notion that basically what's going on in a sporting facility is simply a relocation of economic activity from one block to another block. So that basically is the bottom line. The way we would imagine that you would increase economic activity through attracting tourism is sort of a special case of a general kind of improving your welfare through increased trade. And economists have a really good explanation for why countries engage in trade. Namely, it's a way they mutually can increase their productivity. And there's nothing going on here in the case of stadiums that has that feature to it, where there's some sort of gain from trade to be had from having a fancier facility. The economic logic of regional economic development based upon in tourism or any other kind of sales to other regions is identical in content to the argument for engaging in free trade. And, of course, there isn't some big productivity-enhancing result from this kind of investment. If we ask ourselves, what is the productivity consequence of building a new stadium? For the most part, all of the employment and other costs of a stadium are roughly directly proportional to how many people show up. The only workers whose productivity goes up from a new stadium are the players. So one of the effects of a stadium is that a big hunk of the subsidy goes to increase player salaries, because there's a competition for the players. Indeed, some of the institutional rules in professional sports guarantee that a large fraction of the subsidy goes to the players. Most people know that in a couple of professional sports, in three out of four actually, there are salary caps. What they don't know is there's also salary floors. That is to say, it's part of the collective bargaining agreement in three of the four professional sports that every team will spend a certain minimum amount on salaries. That minimum is expressed as the average, a fraction of the average revenue of all teams. So, a football team gets a brand new stadium. In the NFL, by the way, approximately 75% of the teams are at the salary cap. That the cap is the binding constraint. The rest of them have the floor, which isn't much below the cap. It's only a couple of million dollars below the cap is the floor. So almost every team is, if one team has its revenues go up by $20 million, that means about 60% of that $20 million is going to be passed through as pay increases to players in professional sports. That is to say, $20 million in revenues means $12 million in increases in player salaries. For those at the cap, it causes the cap to go up, and the cap is a binding constraint, so the salaries just go up with it. For the other teams, the floor goes up, and so they have to raise their salaries because they have to comply with the floor. And so a large part of what is going on here then is that the subsidization mechanism for professional sports, to the extent it increases the revenue flow to the team, Mostly what it does, most of that revenue is simply a transfer to higher salaries for major league professional sports athletes. Now let's sort of review how all this stacks up against the reasons we normally think of. There might be some sort of an economic reason why government might want to intervene and actually spend money on something. And we think, well, one reason is government might want to make investments that make us all productive and encourage further private investment. Nope, that's not going on. Secondly, we have lots of programs that are for the purpose of distributive justice, that we want to take money from one group of people and give it to another because somehow we think they're deserving. Well, professional athletes don't strike me as a real good candidate for, you know, I mean, I think if I pass the hat tonight after the talk and ask you all to make donations for your local baseball and football team, I probably wouldn't raise too much money. And I know I would never be invited back again by David. So, you know, no matter where you stand on the political spectrum between far right and far left, there's no one that I know who thinks what we all should be doing is taxing ourselves to give money to athletes because they don't quite make enough money, right? So it's hard to see where the distributive justice argument comes on this. And so what are we left with as why it happens? Well, I'm going to let Rod talk a little about that because he has a wonderful paper on this topic. But let me just briefly suggest what I think are two important reasons why we do it. The first reason we do it is that there's another thing that government does, and that's engage in collective consumption. We have all kinds of things that are collective consumption, where we just collectively decide through a government entity that instead of consuming things as individuals, we're going to consume them as members of a polity. Parks are like that, all right? We decide we're going to have a park. And indeed, we can put symphony orchestras and opera into this. We just decide we're going to have more of it than the private sector would provide at market-clearing competitive prices. And there's no basic economic reason for it other than we just are moved to do it, all right, as collective consumption. It's hard. We can have an interesting debate, a philosophical debate, about whether this is a legitimate role for government and is a good thing or a bad thing. But it's real hard to get worked up about in the same sense that giving big subsidies to professional athletes is something to get worked up about. That sort of stands as a plausible reason when we think about the nature of professional sports, that what goes on in terms of the business side of professional sports is actually a tiny fraction the role sports plays in people's lives. Sports is one of the few industries, other highly visible entertainment industries have this same feature, like rock bands and things like that, where their importance in people's lives probably isn't very well measured by their economic significance as an industry. Why? Because we talk about it a lot. Why? Because we derive consumption benefit just from the presence of the activity and the visibility of the people engaged in it. The Oakland Raiders cannot collect a dollar from you every time around the coffee pot at coffee break time at work. You say, well, what about those Raiders? Do you think they're going to be able to make the playoffs next year? What do you think about them making this trade and all that? The act of talking, we don't normally sit and talk about the replacement of a manager at a department store, or just think Nordstrom's just got this great shoe clerk that they just hired from Bloomingdale's, you know, and do you think that that's going to cause Nordstrom's to take over first place against Bloomingdale's in the shoe sales business, in the retail trade in the Bay Area? We normally don't have those conversations over coffee. Maybe some of you do, but I don't. But we do have those exact conversations about professional sports, which indicates it has a role in our lives that we as economists aren't going to be able to measure very well, and that certainly isn't going to be captured by the industry, which gives us a reason to want to have more of it and to express ourselves to try to have more of it in ways that wouldn't be necessarily captured in a market. So I think there's a pretty interesting reason why at least some people, namely intense sports fans, are happy to throw away money at sports teams. So that's part of it. But I think there's a second part of it as well, and that is basically when you lose a team, it's very hard to replace one. And that's because the number of teams is not limited by the market. All right, we do not have the Adam Smithian world here, where we think of the, you know, the division of labor is limited by the extent of the market. What he really meant by that is, as the demand for a product grows and grows and grows, more and more firms get bigger and they find better ways to make things, and there's expansion of output to meet demand. That's what the whole idea, the 18th century idea of supply and demand is all about, is that in response to a big increase in demand for something, there'll be a supply response. Well, that doesn't really happen in professional sports, at least to the extent that is justified by the market process, both in terms of the owners and in terms of the players. The people who are in the business make a hell of a lot more money from what they're doing than from alternative ways of that you can imagine them spending their time. There isn't really a good supply response. We've had huge increases in the demand for sports over the past 30 years. Average revenues per team in 1970 in most professional sports were in the range of a few million dollars, and the really, really successful teams might make it up to $20 million. And now we're clear into the way over 100, getting into the $150 million range. Humongous increases in revenues, big increases in attendance, big increases in ticket prices, big increases in broadcasting revenues. And this has been partly responded to by expansion, but the number of teams and the number of players per capita in Major League Professional Sports today is lower than it was 50 years ago. In other words, the rate of expansion is less than the growth in population, let alone the growth in income and demand for sports. And this simply is a wise business decision by the incumbents. There's no point of expanding for the purpose of competing against yourself. If it's the case that five baseball teams could survive in the Los Angeles metropolitan area, there's really no good reason for the Dodgers and the Angels to say, oh, come on in, help take away some of our business. They're not going to do that. And so entry into these sports is controlled. Entering by creating a whole new league is extremely difficult because of the coordination problem of having all these teams and all these cities get adequate facilities and having good management and all the rest. And so new leagues almost always fail. So as a result, there's sort of like a natural barrier to competition here, which means that we as citizens, if we lose our team because we didn't give it a fancy new stadium, they have all kinds of places out there that they can go where someone will build them a stadium. And once we lose ours, it'll take a decade or more to get one back. And in any case, to get one, you're going to have to build a new stadium. So you might as well build one for the one that's here. All right. I think that attitude actually pervades a lot of what is going on in professional sports, that this is essentially a bargaining lever. The bargaining position is on the part of the team because teams are very scarce. They can't easily be replaced. And that makes them different than most other kinds of entertainment. Motion picture theater can be replaced. Most other things, a restaurant can be replaced. We might feel very badly if Chez Panisse in Berkeley were to close, but somebody else would come in. And there would be other first-rate restaurants around. That same kind of supply response, if we fail to subsidize and the incumbent leaves, is not available in professional sports. And as a result, we now have two things going on. We have, on the one hand, attachments of fans, and on the other hand, those fans in fear of the loss of their favorite team, which makes them, of course, politically willing to pay subsidies. Now, the last part of the story is the interesting part, and I just leave this as a puzzle. Sports facilities are not good investments. They do not earn a normal return on investment. You go off and you spend $300 million on a football stadium, and the incremental revenue over cost that it generates is nowhere near worth $300 million. All right, it's not a reasonable return on $300 million a year. It's not a normal business before taxes to find it worthwhile to invest $300 million would have to have a $50 or $60 million pre-tax increase in its revenues. And that never happens, all right? That's just way too big for a professional sports team. If you have a team that's taking in $70 or $80 or $100 million a year, it's not going to all of a sudden shoot up to $150 because it's got a new sports stadium. So then we ask the question, well, then why do we give them stadiums? It'd be a lot cheaper just give them the money, all right? And this is legitimately true. Why build a $350 million football stadium if the net effect of the $350 million is going to be to increase the growth revenues of the team by $20 million, and then $12 million of that goes to players, so only $8 million goes to the owner? The alternative is you just pay the owner $8 million. And $8 million a year is a hell of a lot cheaper than $350 million for a stadium. And I just leave it as a puzzle why that hasn't happened. I think politically, people are a little bit unwilling to face the reality that what we have in stadium subsidies is the equivalent of such a bribe. We hide it in a way that providing the in-kind transfer rather than the strict cash transfer, just because it makes it a little bit easier and more palatable to live that way, so it's a little bit obscure that what we're actually doing is taxing ordinary people to give money to millionaires.